This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most, sending a lot of love and light and good energy around the world. It's an incredible time to be alive. It's also a challenging time to be alive. Today's guest has written a book that would really put you in touch with the deeper, higher, and broader aspects of our being. In fact, the book's called How to Be. A monk and a journalist reflect on living and dying, purpose and prayer, forgiveness and friendship. I've been a fan of her work for a long time, so it's a real honor for me to finally welcome to the family and on the show, Miss Judith Valente. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you.
Judith, how are you doing with COVID over the last 2.5 years? It's a serious pandemic, and it's still the waves keep coming.
Right. Well, we have been so fortunate. I thank God every day. We have been so fortunate to escape it, my husband and I. But unfortunately, every day we're hearing of family and friends who have caught this newest variant, despite being fully vaccinated and fully boosted. So that's very concerning. And I encourage everyone who hasn't been vaccinated to get vaccinated, get their booster, wear their masks. It's an act of love to do so.
Do you feel it's changed you at all too? Has it made you more reflective, quieter? Obviously, we had to stay away from large crowds.
Absolutely. I liked to think of myself as an attentive and appreciative person before the pandemic. But every day I wake up now, you know, grateful for just my functioning body, you know, these lungs, this heart, my breath. And it made me so much more aware of the people in my life that, you know, I think I appreciated before, but I really appreciate them now, like the mailman, the people at the grocery store, the UPS drivers who come to my house every other day, my neighbors that I really didn't know. You know, I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, if one of them even passed by my window, you know, just going on a walk in the neighborhood, you know, I'd tap on the window and wave because you so rarely saw people. And I think the pandemic had some side effects that were beneficial that I hope that we hold on to. And, you know, one of them is this, you know, this emphasis on hygiene, on personal hygiene, on washing our hands, wearing masks. I wouldn't mind wearing masks in public places for the rest of my life because I haven't had a cold in 2.5 years.
Judith, have you always been kind of super curious and a seeker in a sense?
Yeah, I think so. Part of it comes from my upbringing. I came from a Catholic Italian-American family, and Italian-Americans identify very closely with their Catholicism. And so I was always around people my grandfather at the kitchen table with his prayer book open in the morning, saying his prayers. And then my mother, when she got to be my grandfather's age, doing the same thing, you know, my mother taking me to weekday mass with her. I also think having a Catholic education made me a seeker, you know, a seeker, a doubter, and a questioner. That's what the Catholic Church will do for you. Give you lots of questions and lots of doubts and some regrets too, as you know, from the abuse scandal and the financial scandals that it's had. But I think that I had a good education in Catholic schools, both my high school with the Sisters of Charity and then with the Jesuits in my undergraduate. You know, always asking us to find God in the everyday, in the ordinary.
I love the Jesuits. Do you still practice Catholicism? Do you go to masses? Do you believe in it?
I believe in the gospel message of Jesus. I love the sacraments of the Catholic Church. I love the Eucharist. They used to call it extreme unction. It's last rites now. You know, the fact that you know, you have that time on your deathbed to make your peace with everybody and with God. You know, I think our reconciliation, you know, going a couple of times a year to actually verbalize what you feel are your faults and your shortcomings is actually psychologically a healthy thing to do. And then to start over with a clean slate. You know, I think some of the sacraments in the Catholic Church make a lot of sense. Some make no sense to me, like a celibate priesthood, for example, or an all-male hierarchy. But do I throw all that with all the other good things that I've gleaned from my Catholicism? And to me, I hold on to what's good, and I kind of put to the side what I think is not good, or try to change, you know, try to work for change for what I think needs to be changed.
That's an excellent life philosophy in general. I can't get past the bureaucracy of it all, but I love Jesus, the teachings, the Holy Spirit. And if you put me in St. Patrick's Cathedral or some medieval church in somewhere in Europe, I can meditate and pray, but I could do that at a mosque or a monastery or at a Buddhist compound. For me, in the Redwoods, anywhere in nature is like the easiest portal.
Yeah, and I totally agree. Those are all pathways to God. I mean, Thomas Merton said, you know, there is no one way. There is no key. There is no key that opens the one door to God, because God is so much vaster than we can even imagine. And I think, you know, however you find your path to your true self, to that spark of the divine within, is a good thing. And who am I to tell you, you know, what's the right way or what's the best way? I'm just not going to do that.
How did this beautiful book come to be?
I've had a friendship with a Trappist monk, a brother named Brother Paul Quinin, for about 12 years now, I guess it is. No more than that, 13 years. And I went to interview him. I was a reporter for PBS TV, and I covered faith and values. And I went to interview him for the 40th death anniversary of Thomas Merton, of course, the great spirituality writer and great, great Catholic thinker, you know, beloved by Catholics and people of other faiths as well. And I wanted to talk to somebody who personally knew Thomas Merton, and I was directed to Brother Paul Quinin, who was a novice under Merton, and Merton had been his spiritual director when he first joined the monastery. And I quickly connected with this monk. I mean, it sounds very strange because the Trappists are a cloistered order. They don't go out, they don't teach, they don't work in hospitals, and certainly they don't have relationships with women. And he and I connected on a very deep level. We both wrote poetry, even though I was a journalist, and I am a journalist, and he's a monk. And, you know, we love reading poetry, so we connected on that level. And we began to exchange a three-line poem every day, a Japanese haiku, and we did this for 2 years. And we wrote a book together called The Art of Pausing, Meditations for the Overworked and Overwhelmed. That was our first book together. And it was these three-line poems plus three-paragraph little reflections, daily reflections to go with them. And I began to realize, you know, over the course of my corresponding with Brother Paul, that he had such interesting things to say, not only about the spiritual life, but also practical things about his work in the monastery, for example, as a cook. He's been a cook in the kitchen for, I think, 30 years at the monastery. That's his job, because all the monks work within the monastery. And it also dawned on me, every time that I would go to the monastery, there were fewer and fewer monks. They were just dying off. And that pretty soon there weren't going to be any more men like Brother Paul who had spent 60 plus years in the contemplative life. So I wanted a way to preserve the wisdom of these individuals like Brother Paul. And, you know, we began corresponding regularly through letters. And then I began to think, gee, you know, these letters contain so much wisdom in them. You know, I was, most of the time I was asking him, you know, for his wisdom on this, that, or the other thing. And he would write back such profound answers, responses that I thought, this needs to be shared. And that became the genesis of our current book, How to Live, A Monk and a Journalist Reflect on Living and Dying, Purpose and Prayer, Forgiveness and Friendship.
Also, I noticed in this current title, it's the title's How to Be and not How to Do.
Right. Oh, gosh. I'm so glad, Paul, that you mentioned that, because one of the biggest things I learned from Brother Paul is the importance of simply allowing yourself to be. I am a workaholic. Maybe you are too. An overachiever all my life. I've been a real achiever, you know, and felt like I had to earn my place in this life. And Brother Paul, you know, taught me, no, you know, that's not it. That's not it at all. The purpose of life is life, to live your life. In fact, that's one of the things he says in the book, to simply be, that it's enough to simply be. You wouldn't be here if God didn't want you here, if God didn't have a purpose for you. So, you know, this idea of I got to have this job, or I've got to get that award, or I've got to write this book, and it's got to be a big seller. You know, that's not it at all, Brother Paul would say. And I'm grateful for that lesson.
I agree with his philosophy. Now, and I love doing things, but I think for me, the key is to just be really present, not be too mind-based, use the mind to execute the desires and the wishes of the heart and the soul, you know, pay the rent, pay everything on time, show up, stop at the red light. But really just to be almost a portal of perception here that just soaks it all in as much wonder as possible, and have a deep foundation of gratitude and just flat out, oh my God, the mystery is just sincerely incredible. Can't even put it to words.
Yes, he's not saying quit your job, you know, and just sit home, twiddle your thumbs, look out, gaze out the window all day. No, he's not saying that. But, you know, I come from a culture in journalism. You know, I started my career at the Washington Post at the age of 21. Okay. And Bob Woodward was still working there. Carl Bernstein, of both of Watergate fame. He was gone. Bernstein was gone. But Woodward was my boss for a while. And all of these people would work, you know, 7 days a week. They would come in on weekends. And in fact, it was frowned upon if you didn't come in on your weekends. You know, people were going home at 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. So, you know, I decided, well, this isn't for me. So I went to work for the Wall Street Journal. And guess what? It was the same thing, the Wall Street Journal. You know, I remember working on a story on a Sunday afternoon with a colleague of mine, because, you know, we were expected to come in if we thought there was going to be some kind of a big story on Monday, we were expected to come in on Sunday and work on it. And I remember my colleague saying, we were on the telephone. He was in New York. I was in Chicago. And he said, oh, you know, I'm just going to put the phone down for a minute. I'm going to go sing happy birthday to my son and come back. I'm thinking to myself, it's your son's birthday party and you're on the phone with me working on this story. I mean, there wasn't really any need for it, but that was a routine kind of an experience.
Why do you think you work so hard? Why are you so driven?
Yeah, well, you know, my parents were hard workers. They were both laborers. My father drove a truck. My mother worked in a food factory. And they were very, you know, they took their work very seriously. They were very reliable workers. And so I had a good work ethic from them. And I had a Jesuit education, which a big motto of the Jesuits is to be a person for others. And that's, you know, that's a great model. That's a great motto and model. But you could take it too far. And there were times in my life that I took it too far, like when I was a journalist at those two large national papers. You know, I thought I had to work all the time or the world would crumble. And, you know, Brother Paul says, In fact, in one of my letters to him in the book, I say, you know, Brother Paul, I think I'm wasting too much time. My days go by and I don't even remember what I did or what I got accomplished. And he said in the book, and I'll never forget this, in one of his letters, the way to stop wasting more, the way to stop feeling you're wasting time is to waste more of it, but waste it intentionally. He said, waste it intentionally. He said, you know, go out for a walk, you know, look around the neighborhood, you know, see what's cropping up in the ground. Go and take a walk, get outside. And he was really right, because I found that when I took pauses throughout my day, which, you know, people in monastic life pause 8 times a day for prayer, they drop whatever they're doing at the sound of the bell and pray. That when I did take these pauses, you know, I still had time enough for everything. I still was able to accomplish what I needed to do, and without running myself ragged, you know, running down my health or getting myself wrapped around worry, useless, what Thomas Merton would call useless care. That was one of his expressions.
That is beautiful. And I'm a huge fan of his. I was sending messages up there trying to get him on the show, but he's in reclusion and retirement. And the monks were so nice, the brothers. But I was like, oh, man, only because a couple other people who had been either mentored by him or whatever. So you have to get Thomas. I said, he won't do it. I would love to. I'll drive up there. I'll do whatever it takes. But he's already contributed so much. Do you spend much time now in contemplation and silence? And after the book, did you feel like your relationship with him and this evolving experience, did it make you more inward or take more time?
Absolutely. I do spend much more time in silent prayer, in meditation. I try to take a walk every day. I also think that the pandemic was another reason for that. Because we couldn't go to mass, okay? Catholics couldn't go to mass during that time. The churches were closed. And so you began to find other ways to enrich your spiritual life, you know, ways on your own. And I've kept up a lot of those ways. You know, I do the monastic liturgy of the hours every day, which is, you know, praying the Psalms, usually morning and evening. Yeah, I don't usually do much at midday, but although they do, I do the morning and evening prayer pretty regularly. And that, you know, sets me on a course. And then I do some meditation at night, right before I go to bed. I do some meditation. I've been working with a Zen meditation teacher for 2 years now. In fact, we started right during the pandemic, and he meets with a group of us on Zoom, and we get some training in Zen meditation. And he talks a little bit about, you know, Buddhist principles, which I find very, they cohabit very well with my Catholic beliefs.
I would agree with that. Why do you feel like meditation is so transformational and just the foundational essential for us?
Yeah, I think we need to clear the mind periodically, and every day. I think we need to have time every day when we simply clear the mind, try to clear the mind to get our focus off, you know, whatever thing we're worried about, whatever work related thing, family related situation, world crisis. And there are multiple crises right now in the world. You know, just simply clear the mind, sit in silence. It can be as simple, Paul, as sitting and looking out at a tree in your neighborhood, and just contemplating that tree for a while, or looking up at the sky, sitting on a bench and looking up at the sky. When I go for my walks, I frequently see now people just sitting on benches. There's a little lake not in a park, not too far from where I live. And I see people just sitting on the bench all hours of the day, just looking at the water. That's meditation.
Have you made peace with the suffering and brutality of the world? Are these practices helping you?
The practices do help. Whether I've made peace with it or not is another question. I mean, I'm as baffled as everyone else, I think, who sees the suffering, the deliberate killing of people for no good reason over in Ukraine. And it, you know, we're focused on Ukraine right now, Paul, but before Ukraine, there was Yemen. And before Yemen, there was Syria, you know, and before Syria, there was, you know, other places in the world, the Middle East, you know, the Palestinians and the Jewish people. There's this violence, this never-ending violence. And I guess what it says to me, as a person of faith, is that I've got to keep trying to be what the great spirituality writer and peace advocate Jim Forrest called an island of peace, for us to strive to be islands of peace in our own lives. And that means, you know, something as simple maybe as not getting agitated in the grocery store when the line is going slowly and the person in front of you is, you know, the checkout person has to go and verify something that they've got in their, you know, in their on their tray there. You know, they've got to check price, so that makes the time in the checkout line twice as long. You know, not blowing your stack over something like that, or somebody cutting in front of you in cars, or, you know, just, you know, keeping our own patience in check and things like that. I think Jim was talking about being an island of peace. And Jim, I interviewed him a couple of years, he just died in January. And I interviewed him a couple of years ago and I asked him about Black Lives Matter protests and protests against some of the things that were going on in our government under the prior administration. And, you know, he talked about, you know, prayer vigils being the way to go rather than protests and demonstrations. And I think that makes a great deal of sense, because there's so much anger in the world that sometimes I think protests, they only pour fuel on that, or they could pour fuel on that. But if we called them prayer vigils or peace vigils, you know, and we all went out with our candles or something like that, that might add something to the soul of the world that a traditional protest march or demonstration does not. I don't know. Does that make sense to you, Paul?
I think both have a place, but I think definitely would not be a negative to have more prayer, meditation, and energetic peace generated. And with all of it, I always wonder too, how do we forgive it all when it's just so much of it is just an affront to our very morality, our senses, our life being, seeing people slaughtered in the streets, kids. I mean, so much is so beautiful, but also there's so much that's just so brutal. And I know one of the doctrines, or most of the doctrines in spiritual traditions, are forgiveness. I guess we have to just keep forgiving over and over again. It's a process.
It is a process, and it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy for the people in Ukraine. And it's not an easy moral question for people of faith. I mean, I say I'm against war. I want to be nonviolent. I want to see a nonviolent world. But, you know, do the people in Ukraine not have a right to defend themselves? You know, they did nothing. They did nothing to merit an invasion into their world, into their lives. And so I think it's a very difficult question for people of faith right now, and something we have to process very deeply, because as you say, how are we going to forgive that? And don't people have a right to defend themselves against this, you know, a sort of an unjust aggression?
There's such challenging, deep questions with no easy answers.
No, there aren't any easy answers. And of course, Jesus, would say, it has to be nonviolent. You know, you have to turn the other cheek. You have to give up your coat. If somebody takes your vest, I think that's what we strive for, but I don't know that we can always practice that. I think it's a very, very hard thing that Jesus asks of us. And that's why I say what we do have control over is to be islands of peace in our own little community, in our own little houses, in our own little lives. We do have control over that. And I guess I'm glad that our government is focusing on these sanctions, because that's kind of a nonviolent response. I mean, NATO could have just as well said, you know, we're going to move in with our tanks and we're going to move in, you know, we're going to kill as many Russians as we can, but they haven't done that. They're trying this other tact. Hopefully that will work in a way that lessens bloodshed. It's yet to be seen though, Paul.
I agree with you. What are your feelings and thoughts on climate change and climate disruption, climate emergency, climate collapse?
Well, I think it's a moral issue. It's one of the pressing moral issues of our time, just as war and violence is. Pope Francis has been so eloquent in talking about the earth and creation as this great gift of God. And what are we doing with that gift? You know, we've done a poor job over the centuries. We've polluted, we've dug up the earth, we've mowed down forests. I live in Illinois, which is an agriculture state. You know, 3/4 of the state used to be savannas and wooded areas. And now I think it's something like less than 1%, because we've turned it all into agriculture. And not only that, but with agriculture has come, you know, pesticides and fertilizers and all sorts of use of chemicals on the land. So we have a lot to answer for. And I think people of faith have to be in the forefront of fighting climate change, fighting anything that is destructive to this mother home that we have.
And given the science, and we've had a lot of the great scientists on, they continue to come on, we're on a mass extinction trajectory, both for ourselves and countless other species.
Right. I just say, remember the dinosaurs. You know, they were the most powerful creatures on the earth, and then boom, you know, they were gone. And that could definitely happen to us. It may not take something as dramatic as a nuclear holocaust. It may just be this constant whittling away of our atmosphere, of our oxygen, of our soil that does us in as a species, because species do disappear.
That's the rule, not the exception.
And it saddens me when I do hear people of faith not taking climate change seriously, or, you know, going so far as to call it a hoax or a political event. As you say, you've had scientists on here who, these scientists really don't have a dog in the fight other than to try to protect the planet. It puzzles me that there would be some controversy over climate change in our churches and among people of faith.
Has all this work and these relationships with these beautiful souls, has it had an impact on your own relationship to your mortality, your inevitable demise, physically, not spiritually? And if so, how has it kind of changed your approach to the finality, the inevitable finality of your being here as the character, Judith?
Yeah, I always had a great fear of death, as many of us do. I, you know, even as a small child, I remember thinking that, oh, someday I'm going to die. You know, maybe it was because my parents were older than other people's parents, and my grandparents lived with us, and, you know, they died, you know, one after the other. And so I always had this great fear of death. Brother Paul, my co-author, has no fear of death. And it's not just because, you know, he thinks because he's been a monk all his life, he's going to go straight to this place people think of heaven. It isn't that at all. He has a concept about eternity as being where we come into the fullness of knowledge, the fullness of all these questions that have puzzled us during our time on earth, you know, that we come into a new knowledge of them, because we will be then wrapped into God's time. We'll no longer be in this finite time that we are in while we are alive on earth, but we will go into a different conception of time, which is God's time, and which Brother Paul would say is the phrase he used, in toto simu, I think is the Latin phrase he used, where past, present, and future are all together at once. And so he kind of looks, as a poet and as a spiritual person, he kind of looks forward. He looks forward to this event that he thinks is what happens to us after we leave this particular consciousness, that, you know, our consciousness goes on, but in a different way. That's comforting to me. I don't know if I completely buy into it. I'd like to stay in this very consciousness that I'm in right now for as long as I can, because I love life. I love people. I love nature. But it's helped me a little bit to release that fear of death as being sort of like, well, you close a book and it all, or you close a book or the film ends and it all goes blank. You know how films just sometimes just go blank at the end before the credits come up. That's kind of how I looked at death previously.
I like the latter view better. How can we move through the world with more love and compassion?
Well, I think far be it from me to give people, I'm an imperfect specimen myself, far be it from me to give a response to that question. I'll just say for myself, I try to be very intentional about it. You know, for example, you know, sometimes I have to collaborate with other people on writing projects and they're not doing what I think they should be doing, or I think they're falling down on the job. I have a choice to make. I have a choice to get angry with them and exchange harsh or critical words, or I can say nothing, which is also, Pope John the 23rd, when asked how he navigated all the kind of tensions and bureaucracy of the Vatican, said, see much, say little. So there's something to just keeping your mouth shut instead of saying something harsh and critical. Or you could try to deal with it in a loving way and say, hey, look, this is causing me some anxiety, the fact that this work isn't done yet, and I don't see you moving ahead on this. You know, can you help me with this? Can you tell me what's going on, and how can I help you? How can we resolve this together? So there's a loving way to do things. There's a critical way and an angry way to do things. And I think it takes effort and thought and effort to go that more difficult route of doing it with loving concern.
If I put you in a time machine and you went back to like your younger self, say she's 14, it's Catholic school, what would you tell her with all you know now?
Wow. Okay. Well, I would say you don't have to work so hard to be of value. You don't have to be afraid to be yourself, and you don't have to earn your place in this life. You, you've been given life as a gift. It's a gift. So do with it, you know, do with it something good. You know, make it a good story, life a good story. But don't feel that you have to somehow earn your place in this life. I guess that's what I would say.
And maybe worry less about the things we thought we were important.
Yeah. It gets back again to that idea of useless care, how much time we spend on useless care. I've found since hanging around with Brother Paul that a lot of the things I worry about simply end up turning out okay. Maybe not perfectly, but they end up turning out okay. And so I really didn't have to worry about them to begin with. So I find I'm saying to myself more often, you know, and it might be something really simple like the car battery is dead. How am I gonna get this fixed and get it fixed in time for me to get to places that I need to go? Well, you know, I'm not going to worry about that. Somehow it's going to take care of itself in its own time. And I'm just not going to worry about it.
Judith, does hope matter? Is it important? Is it essential? Do we need hope?
Yeah, there's an interesting argument about whether hope is optimism, and is optimism hope, or are they different from one or the other? And you know, I think we do have to live with hope and optimism, that they're kissing cousins. You know, we tend to think optimism is a little bit is for idealistic people, and hope is for people who may see suffering, may see things that are not quite right, but still work toward making them better. I mean, I think that the situation in Ukraine is a place where we have to have hope. We have to have hope that cooler minds will prevail at some point soon and see that this is getting it's getting nobody nowhere fast, the way this war is kind of grinding on. And so we have hope for that, and we have hope that the Ukrainian people will be able to go back to their lives, that we have hope that they'll be able to rebuild their country with the help of other nations. They're going to need the help of other nations. So yes, I think hope is essential, because let's say we don't have that hope. What's the alternative? The alternative is to say, the world is absurd. This war is absurd. Why don't we just kill ourselves and get it over with? You know, so hope is that thing that gets us up in the morning, I guess you could say.
And I guess I have to ask you, are you hopeful and optimistic that we as a species will figure it out? And if so, why? Why?
Yeah, I am hopeful. I was very distressed by some of the things that were happening in our country. In recent years, just the vitriol, the me-ism, for lack of a better word, you know, the focus on myself and my rights. And I think that, you know, we're slowly getting back on track. There's still a lot of me-ism left and a lot of anger and vitriol, but I think we're slowly seeing that it's so much better when we don't have that, when we can work together. I think there's that spark in each person. Thomas Merton called it the point vierge, the virgin point, or the white space, the point of ultimate being. And that is that place of God within each person that, you know, I think is going to win out in the end. I mean, we're here coming on to Holy Week. And that's a pretty depressing time. I mean, Holy Week's pretty depressing. You've got this guy who did nothing but try to help people and love people and value people. And he gets nailed to a cross, and, you know, his followers get persecuted. And oh my God, you know, it's depressing. And yet here we are 2000 years later, still saying, wow, this person got it right about love one another as you would want to be loved. You know, this guy had it right. And so I think that's why I still have hope.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.